Hello, and welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce, your radio reading service volunteer, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how those animals affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter from the book Two Good Dogs by Susan Wilson. I'll also be reading another part of the book Strays, the true story of a lost cat and homeless man and their journey across America. That book is written by Britt Collins. And I'll be reading True Tales of Extraordinary Felines in the book Super Cats, edited by Ashley Morgan. And if we have some time, I'll begin reading some essays in Angel Dogs, Divine Messengers of Love by Alan and Linda Anderson. We're going to begin today's readings with Two Good Dogs by Susan Wilson. In the previous chapter, we learned that Skye finally was breaking down and telling Adam about Randy's murder and her fears for her daughter, Cody. And now we begin Chapter 34. Nice haul, Black Molly nods her approval at the collection of drugs Cody has laid out for her, as if she's a jeweler, sans loop. She picks each one up and examines it closely. Any idea which is which? Cody sorts the pills into groups, antidepressants, opioids, amphetamines, over-the-counter stuff. She's pleased with herself, remembering which pill is from what classification just on the look. Maybe she should think about pharmacology as a career path. Maybe she's a natural. Okay, let's get busy. Molly pulls out her ancient iPhone, scrolls her contacts. I hear Ryan wants to join the wrestling team. He's going to need to slim down for that. Molly slides two amphetamine capsules into a plastic bag. That shanky girl, what's her name? Oh yeah, she's interested in anything we've got she can grind and smoke. So it goes on for a half an hour. Black Molly dropping coded texts, setting up a round of rendezvous sites, keeping each client, as she refers to them, separate. I charge on a sliding scale fee, she says. No sense in anybody knowing what I charge anyone else. Cody just wants to leave the goods behind. She wants no part of getting to face with any of those kids. I gotta go, she says. You did good today, Cody. Just keep it up. I told you, this is it. I'm not doing it again. Black Molly flashes her eye at Cody, and then she shows her yellow snaggletooth smile. But there is no humor in her black ringed eyes. Did I mention that guy you say was the driver was shot dead? Shut up. Saw it on TV, execution style. Wonder who did it? For a girl who comes across as a kind of dim, Black Molly has a certain clever wit. So tell me again, why won't you tell your mother that you know who did it? Because he'll kill us, both of us. Not if you put him in jail. I can't take that chance. Please, Molly, don't say anything. Then you know what to do. And I promise you'll never speak to my mother. Deal. The guest in room 12 is waiting for me in the office when I come back from Adam's cabin. I need to talk to you about something. The guest is a guy from upstate New York on his way back to Boston. Arnold Simonson? He looks distressed and a little angry. Of course. Come on, sit in. I gesture toward the pair of chairs at the picture window. The hills are magnificent in their summer dress, every shade of green from lime to blue-green, a flash of white from the occasional birch tree. And then I know that beneath the canopy lies a narrow country road, threading its way up and around the mountains, leading to cabins and homes and overlooks. I wish I was on one of them now, as Mr. Simonson informs me that his pain medication is missing. I had a full vial last night, and this morning it's empty. And you're suggesting that... The kid, that Spanish one, did he clean my room? I don't know the answer to that. I've left Cody to Mingo to decide for themselves what to do. I don't want to hear this. I don't want to have my faith in Mingo destroyed. I've come to like him, but I've let my guard down. He's reverted to a type... Well, at least that's the obvious answer to Mr. Simonson's missing medication. All this I'm clean crap. The crack addict doth protest too much. I'll look into it. Is there anything I can do to help you get another prescription? Making a useless offer is about the best I can do. My hands are shaking. I want to bring Mingo in and shake him until his teeth come loose. Slick boy. I've been Eddie Haskell'd. No, but I think a refund might be in order. My business hackles come up. What if this guy is bullshitting me? How do I know he ever had a vial of painkillers? Is this some kind of shakedown? Some variation on the fly in my soup dodge? I don't think so. Mr. Simonson, I wasn't born yesterday. I almost make that accusation, but I don't. I am, after all, in the hospitality business. Besides, the way this guy gets up out of his chair, it's pretty obvious he's in serious back pain. And then I remember, he's on his way to Boston to see a specialist, and that's what he said he's coming in. Can't wait to get this surgery over with, he says. I refund his night's stay. Wish Mr. Simonson good health. Outside a dog barks, a happy, playful bark. I stand at the door. The late afternoon is hot, but there's a breeze, a suggestion of rain. It's been dry. Maybe a shower wouldn't be a bad thing and wouldn't mean that another rainy summer is inevitable, like the one last year that started my first year of running the Lakeview on such a bad footing. If I have to fire Mingo, it'll just be Cody and me again. With the recent uptick in activity, we'll need to replace him quickly. Maybe this Molly friend of Cody is interested in a summer job. I hate this. I hate being made a fool. I hate losing faith in someone. I hate that I buy into Mr. Simonson's suggestion of Mingo's guilt. But what's that expression? If it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, etc., etc., etc. In other words, if you take a reformed drug addict and, as Adam worried when I hired him, give him carte blanche and guest rooms, that might prove to be not such a good idea. Live and learn. The dog comes loping toward me, Mingo's dog, Fit and happy and friendly, he comes to a halt at the bottom of the stairs and casts his doggy gaze upon me as if he's been looking for me, as if he's looking for something from me. I go down the steps, sit and take his somewhat juicy dewlaps in my hand. What am I going to do? He has no answer. He just gives me his head, and he shakes it a little bit, leer like his ears are flapping. Then he burrows beneath my arm, almost to his shoulders, sucking up the hug. I know that Mingo will be looking for him, and as I have already believed that there is no time like the present to deal with unpleasantness, I sit and wait with Dog for his soon-to-be-fired master. And there he is, baggy jeans and a wife-beater T-shirt. I really need to do something about uniforms. For once, he's not wearing his trucker's hat, cocked sideways or otherwise. He's bareheaded, and it makes him look younger, more boy than man, the state that he is. Hey, Miss M, my dog being a pest? No. Oh, God, my heart's beating. It's beating out of my chest. I'd rather gather myself together as an employer and, well, just not have to, oh, well. Mingo, we need to talk. Come in. The dog starts to follow, mostly because he knows that there is now a jar of dog cookies on my desk. His tail starts up in an anticipation, going from slow swing to accelerando of crisp beats. It strikes various objects on his way into the office, the chair, the side of the reception desk, the door jamb. He seems not to notice, his focus entirely on the object of his expectation. A gentleman, Mingo, allows me to go into the office first, and then I point him toward the guest chair. I close the door. I tell him what Mr. Simonson said. I watch as his cheeks flood with pink, his mouth hardens and the muscles in his neck pulse. His green eyes don't mean mine. He keeps them on the dog, who is sitting on his knees. He strokes the dog. He says nothing, doesn't protest, doesn't explain, doesn't tell me that I'm wrong. He doesn't say a word. Very slowly, his shoulders sag. He leans forward and kisses the dog on the head, then stands up, meets my eye. I don't suppose there's anything I can say that will convince you that that isn't true, that I would never do something like that. Mingo knows the system, knows that the kids like him don't get too many second chances, and that if I can believe this of him, then this is his second chance, and it is finished. Probably not. He considers my words, the defeat shows on him, and he sucks in his lower lip. Eight, I thank you for giving me a chance, Mrs. M. Only a deposed king could have left my office with as much dignity. I close the door behind him and sink into my chair. What will become of him? Adam has opened a nice bottle of wine, made himself a better-than-average dinner of scallops and rice. The dog, supine on the couch, is snoring peaceful, his front paws folded delicately over his broad chest. Outside, the last of the long evening light has faded to the blue-black, and he can hear those bullfrogs ramping up their evening conversation. Chance, move over. The dog rolls from back to side, stretches, and gives Adam about a quarter of a couch cushion. It's enough. Although there's a Red Sox game on, Adam doesn't really feel like disturbing the quiet, contemplative atmosphere of his new sanctuary with commentary, so he doesn't touch the remote. Sky has done a lovely job with this cottage. Of course, Mingo had a lot to do with the quality of the paint job and the way the apartment-size appliances are so well boxed in. Kid maybe has some potential. Good for Sky. Bringing him on, that is. Chance suddenly rolls off the couch to the floor, gives himself a great shake, and then heads to the door. The front door is open, letting in the fresh air. No need for an air conditioner in this high hill country. Nature has its figured out. The dog pushes against the old-fashioned wood-frame screen door, lets himself out. Adam takes the advantage of the dog's departure, swings his feet up onto the couch, sips his wine, considers how much he wishes that he and Gina had found this place a long time ago. She would have loved the cottage. The fact that Sky has turned the lake view into a welcoming place for people like him. Dog people. Tonight, the thought of Gina doesn't pinch his heart the way it usually does. It's less pining than most thoughts, more mild. One thought in a stream that will always have Gina's spirit in its source. The gala looms over his weekend. Ticket sales have been respectable, and the artists themselves have been bustling with last-minute preparations for hanging their show. His tuxedo is hanging in the closet in the bedroom, safe in the dry cleaner's plastic bag. His shoes are polished. Gina would have reminded him to bring black socks. She would have helped him tie his bow tie. She would have overseen the final dog hair removal after he recklessly sat on the couch. Chance is back in the cabin, having figured out how to paw the screen door open. He climbs up on the couch, rests his head in Adam's lap. "Wish you could come with me," he says. The chopped ear wriggles at the word come. "Want to be my date?" Date, an inflammatory word. Poor Kimberly, poor next door Beth. The dog throws a deep sigh, picks up his head, and listens to the voices just audible to Adam, Skye's and Cody's. "You did what? Cody can't believe this. Her mother has freaking fired Mango. I can't believe you would do that. Why, he's been doing a great job, even with his shitty jobs that you make us do." Skye pats the couch as if Cody is some kind of dog that needs to be invited. Nevertheless, Cody sits. "He stole Mr. Simonson's medication, and I have no idea if he's been doing this all along." The heat of realization climbs up her cheeks, and Cody breaks into what she knows is called a flop sweat. Embarrassment, guilt, horror. Oh, Jesus. This is her fault. The next thought is even more oppressive. Evidently, he didn't rat her out. He took the fall, unless he tried to throw her under the bus, and her mother, always her champion, refused to believe him. That seems the most likely. But she has to find out. How did you know? What proof is there? Mr. Simon said his vial of pills, pain pills, was gone. What else can have happened? There is a chance to make it right by Mingo. The chance to utilize her own escape plan that she didn't see a vial, but there was something crunchy under the rollers of the vacuum. Did Mr. Simonson look under the bed skirt? A beat goes by. A second, another, and it's too late. I just don't think Mingo would do that. He's happy here. Sky takes Cody in hands in hers, pats it. If she's surprised that Cody doesn't pull away, she keeps it hidden. It hurts, I know. I really feel terrible about this, but I have to put my guests first. You know that. Cody pulls her hand away, gets up, and stands in front of her mother. Again, she thinks she can finesse the mistake, and again the devil on her shoulder reminds her that the little slip, and she's the one under suspicion. She's the one who will suffer the consequences. She's the one who will trigger a disaster if Molly's name comes into this. Where will he go? I don't know. I'm giving him a couple of days to sort it out, but he won't be cleaning rooms again. That's going to be you and me for a bit. Okay. Cody's mind is racing. She barely notes Sky's words. Do you think that a friend of yours, Molly, might want the job? No! She's done with Black Molly. Somehow, someway, Cody has to put a stop to this blackmail. Mingo is in his room, stuffing a backpack with a few things that he owns. A couple of shirts, socks, and a jacket. The other pair of jeans. The crisp kicks that he wears when he's not working. Can I come in? He looks at her with hooded eyes, contemptuous, but doesn't say no. He keeps stuffing his backpack. Where will you go? What you care? Just out of here. Gone. Back where I belong on the streets with my boys. I'm so sorry. She's afraid to say more, afraid to say anything else, is to admit she understands his sacrifice. A sacrifice she doesn't deserve. Another secret to keep. What does that mean to me? I'll keep talking to her. I'll try to get her to change her mind. Don't bother. Once you fuck up, you've fucked up forever in the most people's eyes. I know I can talk her out of it. Don't you see, girl? It's spoiled. It's done. Let it go. Mingo shoulders the backpack, flips up the hood of his sweatshirt. Get out of here. Get out of my way. Don't go. Don't go, she said. You can stay a couple of days more. Ain't staying where I ain't welcome. What about the terms of your probation? Don't see how that's your concern. It is. I'm the one... Cody stops. Yeah, I know. You stay away from that girl, that fat goth bitch. This is your transformation moment, Cody. Your get-out-of-jail-free card. Don't screw it up. Mingo pauses, places a hand on Cody's cheek. You gotta get over yourself, girl. You'll be fine. I'll be fine. As Mingo storms down the back stairs, her tears flow like no other tears she's ever shed in her life. No longer the tears of selfish child, but the full-blown tears of one who finally understands how destructive she has become. I'd left Adam sitting on the couch, holding an object in front of his face and touching it gently every few minutes. I think it's called a book, but don't quite coat me. Anyway, now it was time for some outdoor fun. Ever since we moved into the little house, we've been having lots of outside fun. I can't wait to see what Adam has in store today. Yesterday, or maybe the day before that, we drove into the sky, then got out of the car and hiked back down. We were pretty tired and slept that night. We slept really hard. Best part was that before we got back to that little house, Adam went into the restaurant and bought back a whole hamburger just for me. I have to work hard to get Adam's attention, pressing my jaw down on his knee, whining, climbing up beside him, resting my muzzle over his shoulder. But once he puts the book down, he's all about making me happy. Go for a walk? Sweetest tongue language ever. Except maybe, want some? It is a spectacular afternoon, made even more special by the fact that he has nothing on his agenda except getting the dog out for a good hike. Later, he'll leave Chance with Mingo and head down to Mas Mocha, a cultural destination he's been meaning to visit since he started coming to the area. Mosley and his crew always speak of it in hushed tones, the Everest of their artistic ambitions. First, he's got to return this book to the little lending library set up in the office. Skye's leaning against the porch rail when Adam comes around the corner. She has this look on her face, inscrutable. It takes some of the natural kindness out of it, leaving a harder beauty. I suppose you heard that I fired Mingo. I hadn't. What happened? Skye doesn't answer. Adam wishes that she could be shocked at Skye's canning Mingo, but he knows all too well that recidivism rate for kids like Mingo is pretty sad. He's sadder for Skye, who had placed such faith in the nice lady's instincts. It's tough to be wrong about someone. It makes you second-guess yourself lots of other choices. Unfortunately, it means that not only is Mingo gone, but so is Lucky, and that is worrisome for me. With no job, no housing, it's not a good situation. She looks stressed. No, I hadn't. I'm not all right, she says to him. Adam climbs the step to the porch, takes Skye by the elbow. You want to talk about it? She glances down at his hand on her elbow. There's nothing I can tell you. It's what you might have expected. Apparently yesterday's openness hadn't become today's stone wall. Skye? Nothing. She looks at him with those stress-bruised eyes, and he thinks he's never looked relaxed or seemed like she takes any enjoyment in this place, in her accomplishments. Hang in there. Adam touches her arm again, moves closer, puts his arm around her. These things happen. He's surprised at his own disappointment in Mingo. It keeps him from suggesting even a hint of told you so. He takes no joy in being right. At the same time, he feels a bit like a sucker. Even he'd begun to believe that the boy was telling the truth. This time she doesn't pull away. Neither does she seem to notice. She's starting and staring over at the parking lot. Her head is shaking slightly, as if she's having an argument with herself. I'm really tired of this, of every day being in a battle. There's nothing, nothing he can say. He can't thrust some platitude on her and not come across as a pathetic old fart. Sorry. Unlucky for you, you're around so much that you end up seeing the Mitchells, warts, and all. I think that's a good thing. Chance has done his reconnoitering of the area and is back up the steps with them. He He presses his head against Adam, then moves to Skye's side, does the same thing with her. Chance, don't be a pest. He's not a pest. He's a good boy. Skye calls the dog back, gives him some love, and gives her a smile. I told you so. He's been waiting for Skye's road to Damascus's moment. Look, this may be the last notice and may be borderline, but would you consider going with me to the gala tonight? A date? If you want it to be. Otherwise, look at it as a nice free dinner and a night away from your responsibilities here. Skye folds her arm across her midriff in the classic body language of uncertainty. He's surprised himself with the suggestion and is equally surprised at his building disappointment. Surely she will find some kind of reason not to take him up on his invitation. Then Skye drops her arms to her side. She nods and says, I think I'd like that. Instead of heading out for the day's planned hike, Adam drives toward North Adams. Turns out that he actually has forgotten to bring black socks. Chance is riding shotgun, his muzzle resting on the half-open passenger window. Adam reaches over and grabs a handful of neck skin. The feel of the dog's soft skin in his fingers is good, and Adam wishes that Skye had such a comfort. I'm going to tell. Every time that text message alert dings, it's the same. I'm telling your mom today. Every 15 minutes, the same message, the same threat. I know what you saw. I know, and I'm going to tell. The threat of it, of Molly revealing the secret because Cody hasn't brought her anything more, keeps Cody staring at her bedroom ceiling. And the guilt over what happened to Mingo vies with her ever-present fear of Johnny coming to make sure there is no living witness left to Randy's death. A stew of worry keeps her wide awake. She wishes that Mosley had given her some pot yesterday, but he's getting cheap with his freebies. God, all I need for now. I'm just doing the finishing touches now. I don't need you for that, he says. She's rolling over and then over again, pounding her pillow with such violence that Cody hears her mother get up to come see what's wrong. Cody, what is the problem? If Skye had stood at the door and suggested a little warm milk might help, she would have just yelled at her mother to get out. But Skye doesn't. Uninvited, she sits on the bed and does that thing that mothers for centuries, since the dawn of time, have done. She strokes Cody's hair back from her face and presses her lips against her daughter's forehead. What's wrong, sweetheart? It's different this time. Skye's voice holds an unlimited reservoir of maternal love. Despite the months of emotional separation, it says, no matter what, I'm your mother. In those three words, what's wrong, sweetheart? Skye has offered her unconditional love, and all Cody wants is to fall into that safe maternal place. Mingo didn't steal those pills, Mom. Skye sighs, then who did? This is the ultimate example of her mother's blindness. A woman who makes no bones about the illegal mischief she once got into has this ginormous blind spot where her pot-smoking, beer-drinking daughter is concerned. Cody is so undeserving of this trust that she can't hold it in any longer. I did, Mom. I stole them. If she thought that telling the truth would be lancing a boil, the relief utter and complete, she is mistaken. The guilt, the grief, and the fear are still there, but halved, shared. She waits for Skye's reaction, half hoping that her mother will do like she used to do when Cody's worst infractions were breaking something and then lying about it. Her mother would always say that no harm would come to her if she spoke the truth. Skye moves her body away from Cody in a subtle retreat. The hand stroking her hair drops. Say that again? And then it hits. Cody, that confessing this theft opens up a whole new raft of problems. Her mother is going to want to know what she was doing with the purloined pills. Was she taking them, selling them? Thanks to Randy, Skye has more than a passing acquaintance with drug culture. Skye reaches across Cody and turns on the light. What did you say? I stole them. I gave them to Black Molly. What did you say? This hollowed-out, repetitious frightens Cody. Cody considers lying, but she finds herself unable to come up with the energy. She made me do it. Cody prays that Skye doesn't ask her how Black Molly was blackmailing her. No one makes you steal. In place of the comfort and understanding, Skye is stiff with anger. I don't know what I'm more upset about, Cody. The fact that you stole the pills or that you let me believe that Mingo, your friend, that kid you begged me to take a chance on. You did it? You did it and he didn't? Skye gets off the bed and begins to pace around the tiny room, kicking discarded clothes out of her way as she does. I don't know what to do about this. Please, Mom, don't do anything except maybe hire him back. Skye stops her pacing, stares at her daughter. You do realize that you've committed a crime? Yes, Mom, I do. I do. Skye's face is that soft lamplight, looks pinched drawn. I guess the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. It's what Mingo said about himself. You are your father's daughter. Cody sits in the office, a pile of paperwork in front of her, wastebasket nearly full beside her. She sews sort of things. File, what should she do, toss the rest. She has no phone. Mom has taken it away from her, and relief is astounding. Without the phone and its near constant texts from Molly, she's safe. In a weird way, it's like she's not being punished. Not only is she free from the onslaught of texts, but she's forbidden to enter the rooms. This is clearly a twisted idea of Skye's, but if she thinks that not trusting Cody in the rooms is a penalty, an illustration of her deep disappointment, Skye is sorely mistaken. A little filing is a fine substitute for cleaning toilets. Being forbidden, the AC, that's a little harsher. She's no longer afraid of Mosley's ratting her out. What more can he do than his own confession that she has done to destroy her relationship with her mother? Stole some pot? Ha, who cares? She's filched actual drugs. Pot's no biggie. She can just hear her mother laugh. It's more that she's actually made some progress in the past few weeks, and even Kieran has complimented her on her work. She's got some momentum going, and being denied access to her art space is painful. Besides, the AC is the only place where she can put everything aside and just focus on something pleasurable. But what truly hurts is being given the silent treatment by her mother, being treated with the kind of hostility that she herself has dealt her mother for more than a year. It should make things easier if they don't speak, that there will be no accidental revelations, but it still hurts. It's the first time in her life that Skye hasn't been there for her. Cody has the bills sorted into paid and unpaid, then alphabetized, arranged by date, and ready for filing. She slices her finger on the file folder. The blood oozes, streaking the top of the folder, where the stain quickly turns brown. She should make a new folder, but Cody kind of likes the idea that she's bled over this make-work world. She hears the sound of the housekeeping cart being wheeled by Skye. Tending the rooms, for the first time in their ownership of the White Elephant, they are at 90% capacity, one room unoccupied, no help. Mom, she glances back at Cody. Doesn't speak. I'll help you. Skye doesn't answer. I'm alone in the office when a rather nice-looking man comes through the open door. I'm a sucker for type. Like Randy, this guy is dark-haired and dark-eyed. He's got a jaw like an old-fashioned Hollywood star, Kirk Douglas or Cary Grant type. A dimple square in the corner of his chin. I give him my best hello when he asks if there's any chance I have an open room. One more room. I can't believe that I'll be actually full capacity with the click of the mouse. Two nights, sweet. He fills out the registration form, slides it back to me. Tom Blair, an address in Rhode Island. He's left the auto information blank. Just fill out the line for your car. Can't think of their tag number. It's a rental. Don't worry about it. Just the state is fine, and make the color if you don't mind. Rhode Island, Chevy, silver. I ask for his credit card. Don't you take cash? Of course I do. This is a bit unusual, but money is money. I'll have to ask for it up front, but cash is fine. Registration complete. I do what I always do, take him to the room, show him the layout, see if he has any questions, and then hand him the key. I like to chat up my new guests, get a sense of their interests, in the case they need some restaurant or sightseeing suggestions, so I ask, are you here for work or pleasure? Tom Blair, a tiny hint of a smile at the corner of his mouth. Both. Chance lounges at Adam's feet, eyes closed, but his ears twitch, keeping tabs on the comings and goings of those walking through the postage stamp-sized park. Adam sips at his takeout coffee, picks chunks of crumbling apple muffin from the white paper bag in his lap. They've just hiked a couple of miles up Mount Greylock, and he's due a reward. His shins are screaming from the effort of climbing up and then down the trail. Chance suddenly sits up, makes a throaty little grumble, which quickly becomes his exciting greeting voice. Mr. March! It's Mingo, dog beside him, wagging his whole body. Mingo, it's so good to see you. Sit down. Adam moves over the bench to give the boy space. He tries to appear sanguine, betraying nothing of his anxiety about finding the kid who has miraculously appeared when least expected. "How've you been? You heard?" "I did." Adam offers Mingo the bag with the muffin in it. "Where are you now?" "I'm okay. Doing day labor. Pays better." "And that's good." Adam runs a hand down Dog's bumpy spine. "Can I ask where you're living?" "I'm bunking in with one of the guys. It's all right, but..." He spouts. "But what? You said you'd take Dog. If things changed." "I did, and I will." Adam can't believe his luck. Patience has won out. "Can I tell you something?" "Of course." "It's about how I got him. I need to tell you that it's 'cause it's why I got to give him to you for safekeeping." If the kid wants to use the word safekeeping to make himself accept the wisdom of this act, then so be it. Guy named Russell had him, training him up, road work and chains and such. Dog was one of four Russell got out. Youngest and biggest. First time Russell fought him, he won. Big. Lot of money. Dog already looking like a champ. It's what Adam had suspected, but expecting this doesn't make the truth of it any easier to hear. I knew Russell a little, like people do. Seen him around and knew he was into dogs. My boys and I ran into Russell one night, and he invited us to see his dogs at work. Now, Mr. March, despite what you think about me, I don't hold with dog fighting. Not one bit. I've done a lot of bad things in my life, but I never looked highly on dog fighting. But I was with my crew, so I went along. First time I saw Dog, he'd just finished his fight. This one he lost, and he looked terrible, bleeding and limping. Russell was mad as hell. Dog's all beat up, and he's cowering at Russell's feet, wanting help. But what I saw was that Russell was going to punish him. The dog looked at me. My heart, Mr. March, my heart died right there. He looked at me to save him. I told Russell I'd buy him off of him. Right then and there, the whole wad of cash I had that I was gonna use, well, for other stuff, I stuck it in his hand. Russell, so mad, he said, "Take him," pocketed my money. Thing is, Russell wants him back, says I stole him. Adam crumples the paper bag, twists it. In some way, this is Chance's story, too. Brutality and hope. I'll keep him safe for you. Where'd you find Mingo? Skye is seated in the freshly vacuumed front seat of Adam's Jetta. She's wearing a silky teal and blue cocktail dress she says she hasn't worn since attending a cousin's wedding 3 or 4 years ago. He found me. Adam has a dog hanging out with Chance in the cottage. He fills Skye in on how all this came about. Adam, I have to tell you something. I should have fired him. I should not have fired him. Don't beat yourself up. There are only so many chances a kid gets. No, no, Adam, you don't understand. He didn't do it. I acted with prejudice and without any proof, and I was wrong. Adam looks over at her puzzled. Then who did it? Skye reminds him of Cody, always staring out the window when she doesn't want to answer questions. Oh, he gets it. That's pretty serious. I thought you should know. I didn't want to keep you in the dark, being that you've been a part of this. I appreciate that. What are you going to do? Such a loaded question. No answer. Can I say something? Skye nods, pulls her gaze away from the window, and looks at him. Why did she take the pills? To get high? To sell. Her friend Melanie Frost, the one who calls herself Black Molly, convinced her to steal them so they can sell them. Enterprising. Like her father. It's like she's running into him, and you know how it ended for him. Adam takes Skye's hand. Don't. She may be mixed up, but I don't think she's a criminal. But there's a rub. She is a criminal. She's a thief. How do I deal with that? They've arrived at Holiday Inn, where the gala is being held. Adam slides the car into a space in the garage and shuts it off. What did Molly say to convince Cody to do this? I can't believe she'd do it on her own. I don't know. She won't tell me. Is Cody maybe the victim here? Adam, it would be so easy to make that assumption, to be, as usual, the parent who sees nothing wrong with her kid's behavior, the one who always blames others. I can't keep doing that. This is serious. Because of the full house, Skye has ordered Cody to spend the evening in the office. She's given strict orders that she has to be smiling and be the face of Lakeview tonight. There was her mother, all dressed up, her sandy hair swept into a proper updo, bare legs above the strappy sandals Cody had never seen before. A stranger, a glimmer of the person she might have been had her life been easier. But she wasn't smiling, wasn't looking the least bit like she was going to have fun. After her begging and pleading to be allowed to attend, Cody had the ultimate humiliation of having to tell Mosley that she couldn't help out after all. not with hanging the show, not with ticket taking, not with being the coat check girl, grounded with a capital G, and she couldn't tell him why. So here she is, alone, hoping that none of the guests will need her. Without her phone, she doesn't even have the distraction of playing games. She's supposed to be doing her summer reading, True Grit, but she can't concentrate on Maddie Ross's life right now. Her own is just as crazy, without having a Rooster Cogburn to help. Cody pulls a couple of sheets of copy paper out of the drawer and finds a number 2 pencil. She sharpens it and begins to sketch. Maybe. Sky won't let her continue the lessons, but maybe she's going to have to stop drawing after all. The long evening light lingers over the hills, backlighting them, an aureole of rose gold light defining the shapes for a few minutes until the darkness overwhelms the shapes. It is so quiet that she can hear the papers, and she can hear the creaking of the crickets, the rush of the car speeding up and over the hill, the sound of the pencil against the paper. Even her own breath. The food was okay, and the free wine was mediocre, but it was a lovely being waited on, and to sit at an 8-top table with 6 strangers and talk about inconsequential stuff, and even art, to pretend I knew anything about what's trending in post and postmodern art. Adam was showing his style as a professional mingler, and I was growing a little bored with the incessant live auction of pieces of art that were out of both my intellectual league and my budget. I wouldn't hang any of this stuff on the walls of my hotel. The crowd was polite, and one by one the pieces sold. Having a good time? It's Mosley standing over the woman opposite me. At first I think he's speaking to her, but when I realize it, he's actually speaking to me. Yes, thank you. I hope that you've raised a lot of money. Me too. He comes round and sits in Adam's empty seat. I'm sorry Cody couldn't be here tonight. She's earned a little fun. My impulse is to say, no, not really. But I don't. She had to work for me, family business. Of course, he gets to his feet. You know, she is coming along with her work. Has she shown you anything? No, she should. For a younger kid, she's got some potential. I hope that you'll let her keep coming for lessons. After her revelation, I'm not ready to give Cody anything. The damage she's done, despite Adam's kind suggestion that it might not have been her doing, is still too fresh, too painful to think about. But for the time being, she's not being able to take lessons. We'll have to see what happens in the fall. The auctioneer announces the next lot, an original Mosley Finch triptych, oil on canvas. To be polite, I fix my attention on it. Our table is comfortably close to the auctioneer, so it is easy to see the painting. At first, I'm actually impressed. It's a pretty thing, very ethereal. Its composition clear in its meaning, not abstract in any way, more like those lush Victorian paintings of the children. And then I realize that I'm looking at 3 versions of my 15-year-old daughter with wings. The auctioneer mistakes my gasp for an opening bid. Adam sees the look on Skye's face. She's looking at that picture. That bastard! The little sketches on the wall have evolved into 3 paneled exploitation of a kid. What Adam had seen in the prototypes, the subtle borderline between child and woman, has been expanded, and he feels himself blush in anger, never a good thing for him, particularly on a night when his dog, his calming agent, isn't at hand. Who'll give me 1,000? The auctioneer is semi-professional and is obviously getting near to the end of his stamina. His tie is loosened. Opening bid. Come on, people. This is an original Mosley Finch. Do I hear 500? Mosley stands nearby, a goofy smile on his face, expectant. He's of the generation that received participation awards and thought that everything it did was perfect. He can't imagine that no one wants this piece of... Adam waits and watches, and when the starting bid comes in at even $100, he raises his hand. It's over in less than 2 minutes. Adam buys the triptych of Cody Mitchell for $135, worth every penny of it to get it out of sight of this crowd. He'll offer an X-Acto knife to Skye, see if she wants to cut it up. The triptych sits on an easel at the back of the room. The overhead lights have been turned up as the crowd departs, some of them clutching their acquisitions close, others just scrambling to get the parking garage out before anyone else does. Adam joins me, a half a bottle of wine in one hand, 2 glasses in the other. Honestly, what do you think? He hands me a glass. Obviously, it's quite lovely. I stare at the three images of my daughter, the fairy wings, the suggestion of the primeval and dark woods. Looking closer, I see that there is actually a theme here, a progression, from the first image to the third. It's a story of transition, a girl growing up. It reminds me of who she was not so very long ago. It breaks my heart that all the lightness Moseley Finch has depicted in Cody is gone. How did he ever see it? Since Adam has never specifically told us to stay, I see no problem with Dog and me heading outside when the screen door just happens to bounce open with the nudge of my nose. It's a perfect night, and I can hear the scurry of woodland creatures beckoning to the chase. We hit on the scent of something I've always wanted to pursue, and off we go, avoiding the man-made trail with its human scent obscuring the mammal, pushing over themselves, through the underbrush, the sound of our passage, no doubt alerting our prey to our presence. We head away from the confinement of our cottage, of our place, away from our better natures. We revert to our wild side, if just for this moment. Being civilized is wonderful, but sometimes it feels good just to be an animal. It's almost 10 o'clock. Sky told Cody she can go back to the cottage at 10, as long as things are quiet. There have been a couple of problems. The couple in room 3 accidentally locked themselves out. Another call was from that lady with the Cairn Terrier, wondering if it's safe to walk around in the dark. Cody assured her that there were no bears this close to the hotel, and that the motion-sensitive lights on the front of the building would come on if anything else was necessary. Other than that, Cody hasn't seen one. She reaches for the closed sign. Outside, there is just the sound of peepers and crickets, the whisk of car tires climbing the hill, a million billion stars speckling the sky. It's so quiet she can hear his breath moments before she feels his hand on her mouth. Johnny Mervyn shoves a wad of something into Cody's mouth and manages to one-hand a strip of duct tape across it, even as Cody struggles, twisting and ramming her sneaker-shod heels against his shins. He's silent, and in the dark it's like she's being assaulted by a phantom, except that she can smell his overpowering cologne. No phantom ever stank of cheap aftershave. She tries to slither out of his grasp, dropping the grass in an effort to wriggle free, but Johnny is twice her size and has no intention of letting his prey get loose. He picks her up, hikes her a short distance from the cottage to where he's got his car. He forces her face down into the back seat, shuts the door with a gentle push, disturbing no one in the hotel with the slam of the car door. He hasn't bound her hands, so Cody reaches for the latch. Childproof, don't bother. Johnny climbs into the driver's seat. It's a short ride. Cody tries the drawer anyway. It won't open. She pulls the tape off her face, spits out the gag. Please, I never told. Why are you doing this? Things changed. Sorry. Gotta tidy up some loose ends, and that's you. He's driving slowly, well within the speed limit, and there are the unpredictable curves on the mountain road. A car approaches from the other direction. Cody pounds on the windows, but the car doesn't slow. She's invisible in the dark. She's inaudible. She sits back against the seat. Curiously, she's not crying or even breathing hard. It's as if a switch has been turned off in her, a brain that once had dictated that she agonize about this very moment, the anxiety that has controlled her dreams and her wakening nightmare of Johnny Mervyn's threat. She has lived for more than a year in fear of this very moment. She used it all up. She's not afraid anymore. Johnny suddenly flips off the headlights and makes a hard left turn. Cody knows where they are, in the parking lot of Lake Harnett State Park, within walking distance of Lakeview, within walking distance of Black Molly's trailer. She waits as Johnny gets out of the car and comes round to let her out of the back seat. Let's go for a walk. She doesn't move, and he reaches in to grab her, yanking her out of the car and into his arms. The momentum ensures that the sharpened number 2 pencil she's pulled out of her pocket digs deep into Johnny's face. I hear an animal in pain. We quickly forget about it. It as if Dog and I latch onto a new scent. This one I know is a rodent, and within the realm of capture, not far away, I can smell the water of the lake, where Adam has tried to convince me that immersion is a good thing. Sorry, not my cup of tea, but I'm happy to wade in. Inspect for any tiny fish. Snap at them. Dog pauses, making me stop short in my tracks. He cocks his head, gives the air a listen. I follow suit. We are definitely not alone in this woods. The sound travels. Others are hunting, breaking through the brush, ducking the low-hanging branches, panting. The faintest of breezes carries a new scent. Human. She turns, cursing the sound of her footfalls against the summer-dried leaf detritus and rocks. She might as well be leaving a trail of breadcrumbs by making that much noise. Cody stops, touches her face where she's been silenced by the brambles. It is so dark, so impenetrable, but only for a little while longer. Already the moon rises over the mountains. It's easing into the darkness. Cody needs to find a hiding place, some place that even if the moon lightens the scene, she'll be hidden from Johnny. Cody leans against the trunk of a pine tree, listening for him as he's listening for her. It catches her eye. The sharp, bright light of the phone's flashlight app is a miniature beacon. She has to keep moving. He's making as much noise as she is, but he has no reason to remain quiet. Every few minutes he actually calls to her, as if expecting she'll give up this game of rag-tag and submit to him. Cody slows to a crawl, begins to walk her way through the mountain laurel and sweet briar, carefully moving foliage out of the way, treading gently on leaf fall. Either her eyes have fully adjusted to the darkness, or the late moon is taking some depth out of it. In either case, she can discern the darker weight of the bigger trees, and she goes from one to the other. "Come on, Cody. Just give it up. Come to me." Johnny Mervyn's voice is sweet. It's seductive. It's a lover's cajole. Another tree and another one and another one. The pinpoint of light is higher than she is, and Cody realizes that she's descending the hillside, that she's worked her way to Black Molly's side of the hill. The half-moon has risen, and although it's lightened and is muted, nothing like the strong light of the full moon, Cody can see not just the darker shapes of the tree, but also the intermediary branches and the lichen. It blends in with the brambles and the deadfall of storm-wrecked trees, the ferry house, the shelter Molly built where they came to so often to share their contraband. You have to know that there's no way to get out free. Yet Cody continues to crawl under the hodgepodge of beech and pine branches, tucks her knees to her chest, and prays that Johnny doesn't recognize her. Not a bolt hole. She looks up, and through the porous roof of Molly's play fort, she can see the pinpoint of light as Johnny descends the slope. She hears a mutter of cursing as he stumbles and slips a little. The flashlight's bright spot reminds her of that tool the optician uses to examine eyes. "Cody! Cody, you come to me or your mother dies first." Her mother, her mother. She's got to get back and warn Sky. There's no more hiding this secret. It's much later than I intended when we get back home. In the back seat is the triptych safe, not damaged, although Adam had suggested that I could take a box cutter to it if I felt I wanted to. He's given it to me. He walks me to my cottage, which is totally dark. Cody's forgotten to turn on the porch light, or maybe deliberately chosen not to. Adam leans in, kisses me, touches my face, bids me good night. "Wait, would you like to come in? It's not all that late. Then I worry that I've become one of those women he is avoiding. I can offer you coffee." Adam smiles. "Let me go get the boys out. Why don't you come to my place? We can have a nightcap." Okay, and at the risk of sounding like a bad B-movie, I am going to get out of this outfit and into something way more comfortable and check on Cody. Except that Cody isn't there, and neither are the dogs. Dog and I are both freezing in mid-step. We're dogs, so we don't look at each other to corroborate our impressions. We both know what the whistle means. Back here. Judging from the faintness of the sound, we've gotten a bit farther afield than we've done before. But the lure of night has been intoxicating to us. We've run to ground moles and voles and even a mouse or two. Dog came closest to achieving capture, but the truth is neither of us actually would know what to do with a mouse in the mouth. Game's up. The whistling continues, and I know that my stellar reputation for obedience is in jeopardy. Dog is scratching, his hind leg going at it, and his chin is in the air, his jowls stretched back in a weird show of ecstasy. I'll give him a moment, then we head home. I put my nose to the air, suck in a snootful of luscious night air, and that's when my ears pick up another sound, and my hackles go up. "I'm losing my patience, little girl. Show yourself or you'll be an orphan." As if to illustrate his point, Johnny casts one last sweep of his flashlight, coming within 20 feet of Cody's hiding place. He turns around and starts up the hill, and he pauses. "Don't think I won't find you wherever you are. An orphanage, maybe a foster home, your grandmother's, whatever, no matter to me. I found you before and I'll find you again. In the meantime, bye-bye, Mommy." Cody can't hold back the involuntary sob, and he hears it. Johnny grabs fistfuls of branches, tearing away the hiding place, reaching in and grabbing Cody by the arm. He slaps her, twists her arms around, clutching both wrists in one hand, wrenching her to her feet. "I'm done here." He pulls his gun out of his holster, frog, matches Cody a few feet, then presses on her wrists until she drops to her knees. Cody screams and screams. Terror deafens her, even to the sound of her own voice pleading for her life. She feels the muzzle of the gun press against the back of her neck, right in place. Her mouth, her mother used to call her sweet spot, and would then kiss it. "Mommy" will be her last word. I had never before set teeth to human, but I had no hesitation in doing it, and doing it with the same ferocity I once used in the pit, in the time before I knew peace. Dog was beside me, doing the same. We knew the right place to subdue, the right place to make this win. This would take the opponent out of the pit forever. I could hear the girls screaming, encouraging us, inciting us to further leave our marks on this singularly dangerous human being. There was also screaming coming from him, the tongue language clear. "Get them off of me!" As I bit deeper and deeper into his forearm, Dog stood on his chest, threatening, but not quite ready to go in for the kill. Behind us, the girl Cody wept, and even over the pungent scent of blood, I could smell the agony of her fear. At the moment, I understood Adam much better, the anger and the rage that he struggled so to keep, with my help, under control. I suddenly understood what anger is. I had never been angry at my canine opponents all those years ago in the fighting ring. But this time I felt a rage that reddened my vision. This striking man would hurt this girl of whom I had grown fond. I would not have it. Dog pushed his face into the face of the man on the ground, and I knew that he, my dear companion, felt exactly as I did. Johnny's phone, the flashlight app still on the ground, well out of his reach, as is the gun. Cody watches as the dogs keep him from moving. Cody picks up both the gun and the phone. Holding the weapon's muzzle down, she speaks to the dogs. "Don't let him up, good dogs." She thumbs 911 on the phone. Epilogue. I feel the weight of another human body. Cody has climbed into my bed, pressing herself against me as if she were much smaller. What Cody has been enduring is beyond belief. The ultimate in a parent's inventory of things to fear for her child, made to keep a secret so heinous that it's nearly destroying our relationship. "Mommy?" I love hearing that babyish name once more. "What is it, honey?" I don't feel relieved. I still feel like I have to lie. "That will pass. By tomorrow, even. It's like you've been wearing a cast, and now that it's gone, you still feel it." "What if he gets out on bail?" "He won't." "I don't know that for sure. A good defense lawyer can come up with anything. So it's possible. But for now, Johnny Mervyn, my guest, Tom Blair, will cool his heels in jail." She snuggles into me, and I nearly weep with the joy of it. Mingo isn't easy to spot because he blends in with the other workers. Yellow hard hat, reflective vest, protective glasses. He's ripping the plywood off the windows of the boarded-up house where he almost died. Adam lets Chance and Dog out of the car, and Dog runs over to greet his boy with a full-body wag. Adam sits in the Jetta for a minute, taking in the scene, gathering himself together. Mingo lifts his face from his dog's lapping tongue and nods in Adam's direction. Adam climbs out of the car, walks toward the boy. Mingo puts out his hand. "Mr. March, what brings you here?" He tugs Adam into a homeboy hug, a gesture that gives Adam an unexpected sense of connection. Of acceptance. "Sky needs to talk to you." "Ain't got nothing to say to her." "No, she's got something to say to you." Sky gets out of the Jetta. It's clear that she's nervous about this meeting and that she's struggling to get words out of her mouth. In the end, she simply takes Mingo's by the hand and says, "Come back." Cody's phone pings with the incoming in text. Molly, her usual threat. "I'm telling." And that's when it finally hits Cody. She's truly flea. She texts Molly, "Go ahead, here. Here's my mom's number. Maybe I'll be doing the telling." The silence is sweet. I took in a great breath of human. It was a smorgasbord of human emotion. And for the four people, it didn't seem to mind my extensive examination of them. I tested for the usual symptoms of unrest and happily found none, except hunger. They were worshiping at the grill, and the lovely scent of meat and cheese upheld their other sense, framing them in a happy cloud. The people laughed. I love that sound, and if I had one wish for canines, it would be that we, too, could make that sound. Instead, I whip my tail from side to side and grin. Dog is doing much the same, and both of us know that life is good, very good. And when our people are happy, well, when they tell us that we're good boys, well, such good dogs, you know, we're happy too. And that's the end of the book, Two Good Dogs by Susan Wilson. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I know I've enjoyed reading it. Although I didn't get to read other books to you during this show, in the next few shows, we'll be reading the other stories that I mentioned earlier, that from Strays, Super Cats, and Angel Jogs. Well, that completes our readings for today. I do hope you've enjoyed them, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how those animals affect us. Until then, this is Joyce for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a member-supported radio reading service, and for Animal Companion saying thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.